Joseph recently wrote a report that overturned some huge assumed thinking. He found that work from home employees are, to a large degree, less of a security issue than many on-prem workers. Joseph discusses the Peltzman effect, the persistent struggles to create security awareness that last past the initial training sessions, and talks about some surprising reasons that higher ed sector has been shown to be less sophisticated in their security awareness than many other industries. Hope you'll tune into this one, especially you security awareness facilitators. You really want to hear this. It's chock full of great advice. And it's all today on CyberWork. Hi, welcome to this week's episode of the CyberWork with InfoSec podcast. Each week, we talk with a different industry thought leader about cybersecurity trends, the way those trends affect the work of InfoSec professionals, while offering tips for breaking in or moving up the ladder in the cybersecurity industry. My guest today, Dr. Joseph Wampa, is the Director of Cybersecurity Initiatives and an Associate Professor in the Department of Information Systems and Analytics in the Farmer School of Business at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. He has more than a decade of experience as an information systems professor in higher education. His primary research focuses on enterprise systems, software security and vulnerabilities, remote work strategy, digital business strategy, and predictive models. In recent years, Joseph has focused on vulnerability assessment, cybersecurity risks, and cybersecurity awareness. Joseph has also authored several books, book chapters, and worked as a reviewer for journals such as Information Systems Research, Journal of the Association of Information Systems, and Information Systems Journal. A lot of journals that all seem to be very tightly focused, so I'm excited to hear more about those. Joseph, thank you for joining me today, and welcome to CyberWork.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
My pleasure. All right. Well, Joseph, I want to help our listeners get to know you a little bit, and I wanted to ask you by asking what I ask all our guests, which is, when did you first get interested in cybersecurity and tech, and what was the initial draw to it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great question. You know, for me, I think that in the early 90s, when I was in high school, I think that's when I started getting a little bit of, you know, that peak for cybersecurity. And it came from, believe it or not, from watching spy movies.
Yeah, okay.
Wow. Yeah. So back in the 90s, I used to love a lot of spy movies, whether it's 007, The Hunt for Red October, The Assignment. And one of the things that fascinated me was always, you know, the clandestine way they used to communicate. That's, you know, covert communication was something that piqued my interest. Mm-hmm. So I finished high school. Actually, my undergraduate was in accounting. So when I graduated, I worked in a financial space a little bit in a bank, and my department, I was in the trade. And one of the things that I also saw in trade was in terms of being able to remit funds, there was always that privacy concern, that confidentiality concern. So I started to think about, you know, even though that we were leveraging technology to be able to effectively remit funds across the globe, there was always that concern, you know, that cybersecurity concern, that privacy concern. And so when I left, I was in the financial sector for 2 years. When I left to get my master's in Finland, I wanted to go into tech and into security. And so when I was doing my master's in advanced financial information system, I started to like encryption a little bit more. So in the labs, I used to play a lot with, you know, encryption, whether it's DestroY, whether it's RSA encryption. Yeah, so at that point, I knew that one way or the other that I was definitely going to be in tech, but I felt like I always had that flair for cyber just to, you know, make sure that you deal with confidentiality, privacy. There were things that were so important to me at that time.
So I want to go back to some of your, you know, the many things that you've written, reviewer for journals like Information Systems Research and, Information Systems Journal. Can you put a big frame around what you do as regards information systems? What is that as sort of a larger concept? What is the scope that information systems covers in terms of?
Yeah, so for example, you know, that's a great question. And there's always that question that always comes, you know, computer science and information system, right?
Right,
so
right.
Me, as an information system faculty member, I'm in the business school. And I think when we think about information system, we think about three key pillars, the people, technology, and the process, right? You know, when you go to the computer science, they tend to talk a little bit of the technical aspect of things. But at the end of the day, you want to be able to look at that intersection between people, process, and technology. And that's what frames, you know, my thinking, even in cybersecurity research. You know, what are the things that you can deal with technical controls? What are the issues that you have to deal with access controls. What are the things that it comes down to people that you have to come up with policies and say, you know what, don't do this, because there's no technical components to be able to mitigate that. You really have to tell, well, you know, you shouldn't share your password. That's pretty much what it comes down to. So
sure. Always important. As long as we get that one, that covers 75% of all ills there. So, speaking to your role at, you know, Miami University Business School, and the fact that you're an actively researching professor on staff, like, what kind of security problems do you and your colleagues generally take on? Are there particular big topics right now around higher ed level research in cybersecurity?
Yeah, thank you, Chris, for that question. Like, here at Miami, I can only speak for the business school and from some of my colleagues here at the business. Yeah, so one of the things that we're trying to look at now, because our research tends to mirror the challenges that we see in the industry. So for instance, now there's a lot of active research going on with respect to, you know, how do we leverage AI? How do we leverage AI to solve some of the cybersecurity challenges we've had in the past? And I'll give you an example. So for instance, we think about things like, you know, data breach incidents. If you think about it, it's a basic data breach. It takes almost 300 days to discover and report a breach. So the question is, you know, with this age of AI, with the new technology that we have, with machine learning, is there a way that we can narrow that time a little bit? It doesn't have to take 9 months. If we have all this stuff, can we narrow that down in terms of being able to identify a breach a little bit earlier? So we are looking at how AI can leverage that. So we're looking at things like, you know, patterns. Can we use AI to be able to create better predictive models in terms of vulnerability assessment, in terms of vulnerabilities that may be exploited? So these are other areas that we also looking at with respect to research right now. And also we're looking at zero trust, a little bit on zero trust, you know, paradigm. You know, zero trust came with a lot of promises. So we're trying to really look at, you know, is that paradigm shift, you know, paying dividend in terms of, you know, the cybersecurity threats and challenges that zero trust was supposed to mitigate? Are we seeing those type of things? Are we seeing how people responding to that?
Yeah, no, that's great, because you're right. There was that wave of a year or two ago where every guest I had come in here say zero trust is the answer. Zero trust is the answer. This is gonna change everything. And I, you know, it's hard to invite the same people back and say, so how'd it go? So I'm glad that you're there checking this out for us. So now I want to talk to you about some of your research today here. So as I mentioned in the intro and at the start, you recently co-written a report through Miami University about some surprising findings regarding the relative level of safety for employees who work on premises at their company's offices versus those who work remotely from home or in variable locations. So without giving away too much of the report, your findings inverted a lot of what people previously thought about which work methods are safer on the whole. So can you tell us more about that?
Yes, thank you, Chris. And so in that research, you know, one of the things that we found, it was we got into that research with certain expectations, and it turned out to be, you know, the reverse, like you said. So, you know, when you think about remote work environment, people always felt like remote work came with inherent cybersecurity challenges. You know, whether you look at expanded attack surface, you know, loss of visibility with respect to the people working remotely. Yes. And you know, anytime you have a distributed work environment, it creates a lot of, you lose, for instance, you know, the infrastructure, you don't own it. So there's a lot of issues. But one of the things that, you know, nobody thought about was that, you know, when people work remotely, our study found that they really kind of had this, you know, a much higher cybersecurity awareness. Mm-hmm. It's like, I tend to look at it this way, that when you work remotely, you feel like, I don't want to be the one that poisons the chalice, right? So All of a sudden, you feel like you have to be a little bit more cautious. So when we looked at the two groups, the groups that worked in premises and the groups that work remotely, it's almost like the groups that work within the boundaries of a corporate environment developed a type of complacency. You know, they felt like, you know what, yeah, the company has countermeasures and within the organizational boundaries, they're going to take care of things. So they didn't have that higher level of cybersecurity awareness. And also they weren't always willing to take precautionary measures, even when they found something. And that's something that we found with people working remotely. And part of it stems from the fact that remote workers also over time, they feel like, you know, they don't readily have an IT staff readily available. They start to do a little bit of things on their own. And I think that really kind of elevated that level of you know, level of cybersecurity awareness that we didn't see within office premises. And you know, when we got that result, we started looking at it and it felt like, wow, when you take a step back and look at that, you say like, you know what, maybe this is a little bit intuitive. You know, Chris, think about it this way. You know, when you're in a corporate environment, right, you don't worry about who walks into the building. You don't care. You know, you feel like the security will take care of that. You know, you might see a weird thing, but you don't really pay attention. But when you're at your home, you know, all of a sudden you have this heightened state of alertness where you're, you know, who is this person? Who is this person in our neighborhood? So that's what we saw in that research that was really interesting.
Yeah. No, and I want to, at the risk of cribbing your report from you here, but your report references something called the Peltzman effect, which is used in findings about automobiles. And it basically stated that as cars added more safety features like seatbelts and airbags and, you know, body structures that crumple and impact in a safer way, that it paradoxically seemed to engender more unsafe driving, which sort of erased some of the improvements that the innovations could have made. And so when you applied, as you said here, the Peltzman effect to on-premises workers, you know, you have this notion that if you have your IT person just down the hall, then if, you know, what's the harm? If I click this thing and it goes wrong, I can just, you know, scamper over there and they'll shut me down. Whereas conversely, workers who work remotely from laptops, as you said, or other portable devices are more cognizant of the potential risks and are engaging in less risky behaviors. You don't know necessarily how to initiate something with your IT person if you're at home and, you know, and certainly not in a quick way like that. So I want to talk about security awareness in a moment, but I want to start first, if possible, with the tech side of things. So a recurring cadence from past guests is that from a security standpoint, security engineers and architects, you know, previously in the sort of pre-COVID times were tasked with protecting a single company, often a single location. And they use the sort of metaphor of like security being like a drawbridge and a moat around a castle. It makes threats hard to get in. But by comparison, they talked about remote workers as trying to fortify not a single castle, but a series of small encampments all over the countryside, a breach of any of which could have a snowball effect. So, Joseph, can you talk about on the tech side security strategies, both on-prem work and work from home? Is there any great deal of difference in the approach between defending the two?
I think absolutely. Yeah. You know, when, you know, think about it, when you are dealing with people that work, you know, on a face-to-face on the premises, that's a different ballgame when people are working remotely. When people work remotely, I think that the threat level is a little bit different and that should also require a different strategy. So for example, you know, think about it, when people work remotely, you are dealing with all this, increased attack surface. You're dealing with people, you're dealing with compliance issues. You're dealing with loss of visibility from the standpoint of what are the people doing, you know, the endpoint data leaks, you know, the data integrity issues. These are all issues that you're going to have to grapple with. Now, when you work in a face-to-face in a premises environment, you have a lot of things that you can control for because those people are there. You can be able to put in place certain control mechanisms. So the difference in strategy really comes down to now, when people work remotely, to some degree, you really have to, you know, they become your line of defense, right? It's almost like the employees have to do things on your behalf. So you become a little bit susceptible to the degree to which, you know, that security awareness or precautionary taking behavior is really amplified. And I think that's what speaks to our research that, you know, when people work remotely, you expect them to have a strong, if they do have a stronger cybersecurity awareness, that puts you in a better position to be able to manage those threats. So, but that doesn't eliminate the fact that people work remotely. They are still going to be exposed to multiple layers of threat. That's true. But we are started saying that, hey, but wait a minute, there's a way for you to manage this threat. And Chris, one point that I forgot to mention is that in our research, one of the things that we also saw that when you have an organization that has a culture of compliance, did increase their ability to take precautions. So not only that remotely, yes, but there was a moderating factor there. If that organization had a culture of compliance, if they built a culture of cybersecurity compliance, policy compliance, that even made it much better for them in terms of being able to manage those people. So that's definitely one of the things that we found in that study.
Okay, could you untangle the concept of culture of compliance? Because I guess I'm trying to get at my head around what companies do not have a culture of compliance. Like, what does a culture of non-compliance look like? Is it just that that it's kind of flying by the seat of their pants or something like that? Like, what sort of sets apart a company with a culture of compliance? Is that they're going above and beyond compliance for security?
That's a great question, Chris. And in research, one of the things that we've found over the years is that there are certain industries, for instance, that tend to have a higher level of compliance. And compliance in this case being able to meet those policy compliance, regulatory compliance with respect to, you know, policies, policy frameworks on how to navigate your day-to-day job activities. So I would use, for instance, when you think about the financial sector, they tend to be up there in terms of compliance. When you think about, for example, the educational sector, when you think about, for instance, you know, hospitality, they tend to be at a very lower level. So we tend to see that. And that just comes from, maybe comes from, you know, how fine-tuned the policies are. Chris, you and I know very well that sometimes a lot of companies do have policies, but sometimes when you look at those policies, they tend to be a little bit ambiguous. You know, it seems to, well, you know, be careful why you do this, you know, do that. Yes. It becomes very difficult to enforce. And those are the areas that we see that, well, it appears that this industry doesn't have a very strong compliance culture. They don't have a strong culture. So that's what we mean by that, that you have to be very specific. You have to have a policy that is really very specific, that's not vague, not ambiguous, that everybody thinks is okay, you know, who cares, it's just what it is.
Yeah. And I suppose that's something that not just if you're trying to get a job in this place, you know, obviously as a security person, you want to know whether you're coming into a place that has that commitment to compliance level security. But I imagine even if you're just working in any other part of the company, you would want to know whether or not you're, you know, so like talk about, it's like if you're not security person trying to come to a company, how do you sort of research whether or not your company sort of has this high level of like security compliance culture to it?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, when you think about, you know, having this security culture is something that develops over time, right? You know, it sometimes is driven by the industry, it's driven by the regulatory requirement, it's driven by a lot of compliance issues that you tend to have. So, for example, when you think about like, you know, the hospitals, you know, there are certain areas that they have certain laws, certain regulatory oversight that really forces you to be able to comply with certain type of standards. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the posture that you come in, when you come in, you know, what are the things, what are the do's and the don'ts, you know, what are the things that is a no-no, how do you, you know, what are the key standards? And I think those standards are enforced by trainings, by, you know, policy formulations that are very, very specific in the role against that one shouldn't do. You know, it's okay, like, well, you know, you shouldn't take certain, you know, certain resources, certain information at home and take into devices that are not company sanctioned. So these are little things that I think that's how that culture is developed. And when people fall in, they realize that there's that elevated culture, because we've seen people move from organization to industry to industry, and they really say that, oh, wow, you know, when I moved to this industry, things were a little bit different. And so it comes over time, definitely.
Well, that's great. That moves into one of my next questions real quickly. I want to talk about security awareness among your workforce as well. So going back to the Peltzman effect, it seems, as you said, that remote workers are more aware of threats due to their relative isolation and feeling of not being able to pop around to the IT person if something looks fishy, and on-prem workers assume everything will be fine if they, say, simulcast a game on a second screen while they work, maybe click on that pop-up for a free raffle drawing that just appeared. But in your findings, what were some of the best lessons, whether these are compliance-related or just corporate culture related, that you saw being taught in terms of making sure that your remote workforce is using and internalizing security awareness best practices in their work? Do you have some examples of companies that where there was an especially high level of security awareness and a low level of sort of breaches? And what was sort of the thing that tied those together?
Yeah, so like I was saying earlier, one of the things that we saw that kind of tried to tie them together was just, you know, having that culture, having that security posture already that allowed to be able to, you know, comply to certain state of things. They, you know, when we look at this, you know, that this particular employees that were working remotely, one of the things that really came up, like when you look at people that came from companies that had a very established culture of, you know, this, well, we're working remotely, here's what we're supposed to do, as opposed to companies that moved in a remote work environment because of COVID, and some of these things were a little bit vague. So yeah, we saw that those things did manifest a little bit with respect to those companies and in terms of how they were able to deal with that. And we also, when we think about this complacency, one of the things that we also has to be careful, and we saw that, is that sometimes too, you know, we weren't sure how long this heightened state of awareness for remote workers will last, because at the end of the day, it complacency can also set in, like in terms of when we think about moral hazard, right? Like, mm-hmm. Well, we do have multi-factor authentication. We do have access control. I'm using a VPN. To what degree does this start to kind of make you a little bit more complacent as well as time goes on? So that's a follow-up work we're trying to do and see how, you know, does that heightened state of cybersecurity awareness and precautionary taking behavior, is this something that peters out over time?
Yeah.
When they start to kind of familiarize themselves a little bit. So that is something that we are looking at the moment.
So the tech level might well be recreating the Peltzman effect, in the sense of people are feeling, well, I've got a VPN, I've installed all the things that my IT guy told me to install on my laptop, so you know, we're probably fine, kind of thing.
Correct. So, yeah. So that is the challenge.
Yeah.
And so, but at the end of the day, you know, one of the things that we try to, in argument we make in our paper, is that this allows companies to have these intervention mechanisms, knowing fully, okay, how do we intervene, knowing that this is what is happening. So the question now becomes, how do you continue to, you know, make sure that that cybersecurity awareness is not diminished to the level where they can't take these precautionary behaviors when something happens?
Yeah. Do you have any sort of thoughts on internalizing security awareness best practices, especially for places where you've already seen that it's bad? Like, and also, I mean, it's with these kind of overarching cultures, especially when it's a culture of like, it's not put down in set in stone. So it can be hard when you suddenly set in stone, like, you're not allowed to do this anymore. You're not allowed to do this anymore. Have you found any sort of patterns in terms of what worked well in terms of getting people, security awareness, buying into it without feeling like they're getting all their freedoms taken away or whatever?
Well, Chris, you know, at the end of the day, that's the holy grail, right? That's what everybody's racing to accomplish, you know, to find that. I'll give you an example, for instance, in higher education, for example, we tend to really lag behind in terms of cybersecurity awareness. And how do we know that? So we do a little bit of a simulation of, you know, phishing behavior, and we tend to have a higher than normal click rate within the universities. And there's a lot of arguments for why that happens. Maybe they just don't have enough funding in terms of tech. They just a large, you know, volume or size of people, the student, the faculty, and all that. But the question is, how do we try to, you know, increase that cybersecurity awareness? And one of the ways we've tried to do that, you know, obviously most companies try to enhance their cybersecurity awareness to trainings. So the question is that, but what we've seen in the past in terms of prior research is that trainings seem to be something that, yeah, you know, it gives everybody that heightened state of alertness for just a brief period, and then everybody goes back to where they were originally. So the question now becomes, you know, how do you incorporate that training in such a way to have a long-term goal? And the jury is still out how to do that, because part of the challenge, Chris, is that most people are also under pressure to deliver in their respective job roles, right? You know, cybersecurity, it's necessary, but it's not sufficient. That's not their primary task. At the end of the day, if I'm in sales, I'll still be judged based on my sales output, right? And not the fact that, you know, well, I was able to meet all the cybersecurity policies. No. So this is the dilemma that we face in trying to tailor and structure training programs that will be able to force employees to have that heightened state of alertness, have that enhanced cybersecurity awareness. So the question is, That question is something that continues to be ongoing, being able to tackle this training. And it's always going to be different across industry, across even employees, if you're at the managerial level, at the lower level. So there's just it has a lot of complexities. And I think that's why it continues to be a challenge.
I imagine that the fact that, as you said, you get one training once a year and then forget about it. And then your knowledge, I guess it's like if you were to like try to learn a language and you tried to learn, you know, Spanish in a weekend and then you didn't speak it for 6 months, then yeah, you're going to forget it after a while. But I mean, have you seen any other sort of recurring patterns of things that seem to be going in the right direction in that regard in terms of retention of knowledge?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we've seen is that it's not so much training might not be what will help you get to where you're going. But we are beginning to see is that when you look at it in terms of risk, when you not bring people in and say, well, this is an inherent risk of doing business. Mm-hmm. Here are the potential challenges that we're going to, here's the potential drawbacks. These are the problems that we're going to encounter in the event that this happens. That tends to have a much more profound effect as opposed to saying training. The training appears to be like, you know, I checked the box. Yeah, I've gone through the training. Okay, what else? Let's move on. But being able to have that sensitization, not so much about training, but being able to give them the knowledge and skills of saying, hey, here's what happens in the event that this thing, if we have this type of threat, if we have a data breach, this can lead to these consequences, it gets people's attention. So, and I think a lot of companies that are able to use that as a way to intervene and as a way to increase that are being a little bit more successful as opposed to people that are really limited to training alone.
Now, out of curiosity, you mentioned a little bit that obviously higher ed is sort of a target area that you're looking at. Have you seen any particular patterns or insights around security awareness in the higher ed space? Are there particular blind spots that are specific to higher ed that you don't see in other areas? Because I know I've heard that as well, that higher ed has maybe a lower, you know, higher rate of, security issues and so forth than maybe some other industries. But like, where do you see the blind spots in higher ed in terms of security awareness and security posture?
I think that's a great question. So definitely when we think about we use the classical case of phishing, right? Mm-hmm. And like I was mentioning, when you think about phishing and think about click rate, anytime you run simulations, there's a lot of studies that have demonstrated this, that when we run simulations across industries, the higher ed, they tend to come up at the lowest level. You know, they have the highest click rates. And the question is why? And I think part of that has to, even when you eliminate tech savvy sectors, you know, when you equate them with construction, when you equate them with, they still come out at a very, lower at the bottom of the table. And I think part of that challenge has to come from the fact that it's almost like higher ed seems to be like almost like a distributed work environment where everybody is their own, specific bosses, they come in and do their research. Right. So they don't tend to see the big picture of how, distance poses a very significant threat. And I think that's part of the challenge. So because one of the things, Chris, this is, you might be interested to know this, that we've had simulations when we've run on the universities and the same set of people, they click the simulated phishing attacks and they click it all the time. And then you go back to them and say, oh, well, you have to go through some training. And then you run it months later and you still get the same click rate. And you're like, what is going on? And I think it has to do with that level of awareness that in our country, in the US, there has to be an effort to get people to really buy into cyber, to buy into the threat, understand that this is an inherent risk in your daily lives. And unless that happens, I think that these measures, whether it's training, whether it's forcing to do it, are more cosmetic in nature because they don't really, and I think that's why people that work remotely, one of the reasons why they were successful at increasing their cybersecurity awareness because they consciously wanted to do this. Therefore, I don't want to be the reason why something bad happens to the company. No, I'm going to pay a little bit of attention. And I think that's what we need, even in higher ed. So, for example, if you go to finance, for example, you know that, okay, well, folks come in there, they understand the ramification. They know that this is a very sensitive area. So they almost come in with that level of awareness as well. And that's one of the reasons why they're a little bit more cautious. But in other areas where, you know, the implication, what if a university has a data breach? Okay, well, you know, but it's not something that is going to be the kiss of death. No, you know, what is the worst that can happen? So creates that sense of complacency. And that is part of the reason why we are still, you know, grappling with some of this, you know, cybersecurity awareness within the higher ed industry.
Yeah, that's interesting. One thing that sort of sprang to mind with regards to the cautiousness that a remote worker has, and I'd never really thought of this before, but the idea that, you know, you say, I don't want to be the one, you know, the breach happens to. But I think there's also maybe a little carried implication that if I'm the one that gets breached and it happens when I was working remote, we might lose remote work from home entirely. Like there's that double feeling. If we have this thing that we like is precariously in our hands, and this would we could very well get pulled back to the office if we don't do it. So that's really an interesting thing. Now I wanted to poke at something, and maybe this is sort of not a correct assumption, but like with regards to higher ed and the high rate of phishing, you know, one of the things I say about phishing attacks is that, you know, especially in a lot of cases, they are written in a deliberately clunky way with the idea that they're not aiming at people who have like a higher than average sense of English language. They're looking for people who they think are more likely to sort of be credulous or take the, but you know, in higher ed, it seems like you would see even more, you know, especially if you're like in the sort of like humanities, like you would notice like the awkward wording of a phishing email and stuff. And I don't know they're necessarily getting like more refined version of phishing. Is there any aspect to that in terms of, you know, the parsing of a phishing email at a higher ed level?
Well, I think at the end of the day, you know, the challenge has always been, I think when, you know, phishing attacks have always been successful, has to do with the fact that, you know, the recipient of the information has really this wide range of emails. Like Chris, you know, as a professor, I get emails all the time from students, you know, so many students that I'm dealing with. At some point, there's a fatigue that sets in.
Yes, you know, that's true.
Paying attention to all this stuff. If you're going to get 200 emails a day, then at some point, that really, you know, peters out things, and then you're not really paying specific attention. And I don't think that's necessarily the case for other sectors where you're dealing with a very specific customer. We have this, you know, one-to-many relationship with our students, and that can be a challenge.
Yeah, and I guess I hadn't thought about that too, that you might, you know, have to be still answering emails at 10 o'clock at night, and you're already naturally fatigued at the end of your day and stuff. So that's a really good consideration. So we've talked a lot about the 2020, obviously, was the year that, you know, the great, you know, remote work phenomenon, a lot of places transitioned very quickly into this whole new paradigm. You know, might have taken weeks, months, even a few days, and suddenly you had to completely change your security posture and the way you did business. Like, I'm guessing by now that most places have figured out their remote strategies, but are there any persistent blind spots from the sort of security engineering architecture side that have popped up in this first wave of everybody homeworking that you see that are still sort of persistent, or did, has that all sort of course corrected itself in 3 years?
You know, Chris, that's a great question. But, you know, to tackle the question, I would say this, that, you know, there are certain risks that are not going away anytime you're working remotely. It doesn't matter whether it's prior to COVID or post-COVID. Those risks are going to be there. You know, the reality of working remotely is that when you do work remotely, you know, there's always going to be a challenge with data, you know, in transit and data at rest. These are going to be potential issues. Well, you can mitigate them with VPN. But again, you know, just because you use VPN doesn't necessarily assuage the pain. That doesn't mean that, you know, you are not immune to these challenges. You know, a VPN is not the panacea. A VPN is just an encryption. At the end of the day, how strong is that encryption? You know, how strong are the key sizes? These are all issues. And then what about the endpoint itself? What about the device? You know, that you're using, you know, is the device patched to the level that, you know, it doesn't do. So these are all, those challenges are not going away. And at the end of the day, you still have to grapple with some of those blind spots in a distributed work environment. And think about it, in when you work within the premises of a company, there are certain safeguards that they can put in place. You know, they have their firewalls, they have the network segmentation. They can say, you know what, let's kind of start to hedge the risk a little bit with segmentation. Those things are not going to exist in a remote work environment. You are more susceptible to the person, to how the cybersecurity hygiene that they have. And that is going to be the challenge. And people always think about it like, you know, what's good is access control. What good is encryption if somebody's credential is compromised?
Right. Okay. So, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, so that those challenges are always going to be there. And I think that in a remote work environment, your best bet is why it's so critical that you want to make sure that that end user, that your employee understands the vulnerabilities that that are going to be there when you work remotely.
Yeah. Okay, so we're starting to wrap up a little bit, but I want to ask you a little bit about the sort of learning, study, career side of this. This is the CyberWork podcast, after all. So for listeners who are interested in becoming security awareness professionals, whether teaching security awareness or creating security awareness materials, or, you know, getting, you know, people into, you know, to think seriously about cybersecurity awareness, do you have any tips or recommendations for any types of learning or experiences or certifications or skill sets that they should be trying to get? Like, what are some of the things that you've seen among security awareness educators that make them especially good?
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question. And I think this comes back to what I said earlier on, that sometimes we tend to put so much emphasis on the technical side of things. And, you know, sometimes we tend to forget that we're dealing with people, right? Right. At the end of the day, when we think about, you know, cybersecurity breaches, cybersecurity threats, we still see that 80% of those really have to do with human elements. So I think it's really when you're looking at cybersecurity awareness, and I think that's what we do in RaySearch, let's start to look at the human being and look at ways, you know, from a psychological point of view, from their behavior, how can we induce this type of behavior? What are the mechanisms? What are the, you know, what aspects can we tweak a little bit? You know, what intervention schemes can we put in place to get that? It's not always going to be the technical solution. Right. And I think this is part of the challenge that we face in the cyber ecosystem today, because when we think about phishing has been there for decades. Why is it that we haven't tackled that problem? Because it's a human problem. It's not a technical problem. You're not going to fix it with writing some bunch of codes. No. And so this is where you have to start looking at there, being able to align that technical component, process component, and the people. And I think that's what makes you a good, you know, cybersecurity awareness researcher. You know, if you want to make build a career there, that's what you have to look at. What is it about people? How can we look at people as a human being and say, what is it that we can tweak a little bit? Yeah. How can we intervene in a favorable, positive way that will help make cybersecurity risk something that people will be at their fingertips?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. And another thing that we talk about here all the time is that people are intimidated by getting into cybersecurity if they don't feel they have a baseline tech experience. And it sounds like, especially with security awareness researchers or educators, professionals, that you know, we're always interested in people switching to cybersecurity later in their career. And it seems like maybe someone who has a background in counseling or psychology or psychiatry, yeah, or would make a really good example. Is that something that you've seen as well?
Absolutely. Absolutely, Chris. And I would throw this in there. Like, so think about, like, you know, things like insider threat. Yeah. And that's a potential threat that happens within an organization. You know, how are you going to be able to look at a profile and say, well, you know, based on this, this is a potential candidate that something maybe we need to watch closely. These are critical questions that comes from not so much about from the technical aspect of things, but from the psychological aspect of this, from the behavioral aspect of this, that will play a leading role in that as well.
Yeah, that's great. I hope we get to see a lot more people sort of moving into this space from areas that work with sort of human empathy and sort of human understanding and so forth. So as we wrap up today, Ken, I'd like to ask this of my guests. Can you tell our listeners the best piece of career advice you ever received?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say that for me, I think is I always think about it in terms of innovation and in terms of being dynamic. I really think that one of the things that cybersecurity brings for me personally is that ability to always evolve, you know, looking for something new. If you're an individual that you really values the search for knowledge, you really value innovation, you want new things. And I think that's this is a space for you because it gives you that ability to always be on top of things. Things are moving at a very rapid pace. Things are radically changing. And so that eliminates that. Because here, when you think about us in academics, sometimes we tend to wallow in silos. After a while, you know, this is your expertise. You know everything about this and that. Yes. And but for, you know, technology as a whole and cyber in particular, it really allows you to be able to evolve. And that ability to evolve and solve problems as they come, it's such a great, you know, characteristics and such a great element of cyber that I feel that if you that's something that will always keep you on your toe. And that's, you know, it just gets me very excited every time. So if you have the passion, if you have the excitement, if you love new things, if you love innovation, if you like dynamic, changing, fluid environment, I would say definitely cyber is for you.
It's interesting. Yeah. A couple weeks ago, I talked to another guest, Sean Falconer, and I asked him the same question. And he specifically called out an old professor of his. And the professor said, one of the things I don't like about people with doctorates is that they think they know something. And the idea that, like, and it's exactly what you said there. Once you feel like you've had a degree conferred upon you, that you're done learning. you might have to maintain it a little bit or what have you. Yeah. But you know, it's like I won a marathon once, and now I don't have to exercise anymore or something. Yeah, like that. Yeah. So that's really interesting. Okay, so that's the second one now that I've gotten. I think there's something really important about that. Like learning never ends, and love of learning is you just can't let it go away.
Yeah. Agreed.
So before we go, Joseph, could if you'd like to tell us anything about your department at Miami University and other research or exciting projects you're working on, feel free to do so here.
Oh, sure. So my department at the Pharma School of Business is Information Systems and Analytics, and we have a very unique undergraduate cybersecurity program. And so that's a cyber management program. And so we have this unique blend of an undergraduate program in cyber. It's not so much about the technical aspect, but it's more like in risk management, being able to understand your cybersecurity risk. So we train business students that have a strong understanding of cybersecurity from the standpoint of risk assessment, from the standpoint of coming up with, you know, policies that will mitigate risk, being able to have that ability to assess risk. So most of our students tend to be consultant, they go into consulting within the cybersecurity space, within the cybersecurity ecosystem. So for instance, when you're looking at things like mergers and acquisitions, supply chain, being able to look at a supply chain environment and identify risk from multiple parties, multiple vendors, before you get into those type of arrangements. So these are the things that our students really do. And we think that that's a very niche-based program for our undergraduate students. So if anybody's interested in that type of program, look up Miami University Information System Analytics Department. And we do also a lot of research, like I mentioned, in AI, in especially behavioral research, trying to understand how we can continue to use people as a means of mitigating cybersecurity threats within the industry. So that's the areas of research that we do. And we definitely have in the past partnered with professionals. So and we do welcome that partnership, and we continue to look at how we can partner with professionals that you talk to all the time, Chris, so that we can continue to understand the risk out there and be able to conduct a meaningful research.
Love that. One last question. I'll let you go here. If our listeners want to learn more or connect with you, Joseph Wampa, or check out your report's findings, where should they go online?
I would say go to Miami University, you know, put my name there. Like I said earlier, I'm also the director of cybersecurity initiative at the Pharma School of Business. And as part of that role, we do a lot of collaboration. We do a lot of, we invite guest speakers as well to come and sensitize our students. At Miami, one of the things that we try to do here at the Pharma School of Business is to make sure that cybersecurity footprint gets into across all departments, whether it's finance, marketing, management. And at the end of the day, cybersecurity risk is an inherent risk of doing business. So everybody has to be able to understand that and make the necessary adjustments. So go to www.miamioh.edu. Get to the business school, Pharma School of Business, and definitely you will find me and see interesting things that we are doing.
That's awesome. Yeah. The cybersecurity is the secret sauce that sort of drives all the other departments as well. That's great.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much for this really, really enlightening talk, Joseph. I really enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you.
Sure. My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Chris.
And as always, I'd like to thank our 80,000 plus CyberWork viewers and subscribers on YouTube. Your input and enthusiasm makes this a joy to do each week. And if you have any topics you'd like us to cover or dream guests you'd like to see on the show, always feel free to drop them in the comments below. And we have a little community on our YouTube page as well. Feel free to make comments over there. But before I let you go, I hope you'll remember to visit infosecinstitute.com/free and get a whole bunch of free and exclusive stuff for CyberWork listeners, including the trailer for our security awareness training, Work Bites, which is just hilarious and awesome. And I encourage you to watch it. So, do you have better security awareness skills than your coworkers? And then I ask, what if your coworkers were a pirate, a vampire, an alien, a zombie, and a fairy princess? Go check it out. Find out for yourself. InfosecInstitute.com/free is also the place to go for your free cybersecurity talent development ebook, where you'll find in-depth training plans for the 12 most common security roles, including SOC analyst, penetration tester, cloud security engineer, information risk analyst, privacy manager, secure coder, and more. So one more time, that's InfosecInstitute.com/free, and the link is in the description below, along with Joseph's info. So one last time, thank you again to Joseph Wampa at Miami University in Oxford, Ohio. And thank you all so much for watching and listening. And until next week, happy learning.
Thank you.
How about some free cybersecurity training resources for you and your team? Just go to infosecinstitute.com/free to get ebooks, training guides, and more than 100 cybersecurity training courses, all free for CyberWork listeners. Go to infosecinstitute.com/free and start learning crucial new skills today.